The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So welcome, everybody. Happy late Halloween. My name's Paul, and this is my first Dharma talk, and I was hoping nobody would show. So you've disappointed me. I thought you'd be at Halloween parties and tired for the night, but anyway, I'm happy to be here, and I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I'm one of the co-facilitators for the Mindfulness for Educators group that we started about 6 years ago at Common Ground, and I also started the teen group here at Common Ground, which now Shelley runs. And Mark asked me about a year ago to give a talk on daily practice, and I've been procrastinating ever since. So I've had a long time to prepare. But the reason why he asked me is because I don't do a lot of long retreats. I probably have done maybe 4 or 5 long retreats in my life, and I've been practicing for about 20 years. And I ground my practice in my daily life, and I have a very full life. I'm a teacher and an instructional coach at a public elementary school here. And I'm a parent with 2 kids. And so I don't have a lot of time to go on retreats. So I really value the practice of my everyday, ordinary life as sort of the foundation. So I'll talk to you a little bit about how I practice in the past and what really helps me sustain the practice. And then I'll allow Wynn to talk a little bit about her practice. And then we'll open it up for discussion in the end. So for me, the practice of mindfulness always had to be relevant and applicable and grounded in real life. I was not interested in theoretical aspects of Buddhism. I didn't care about metaphysics. I wanted something that I could apply to my everyday life and something that was powerful. And when I came to Common Ground, this is back at Mark's house, I was a new teacher working in Minnesota. I was very stressed out. I was overwhelmed. I was disillusioned about my job. And I was reactive with my students, very emotionally unbalanced, and not a lot of mental clarity for seeing and understanding what was happening. And so I came to the practice for survival, you know, survival in the jungle. And it was more about reducing stress than really gaining wisdom. But I knew from my first retreat experience that in order to relieve yourself of stress, you need to have momentum and continuous mindfulness throughout the day. And so I had some, I gained a little bit of insight on my first retreat, but I couldn't sustain it. And right after the retreat was over, all the defilements came back into my mind. And so I knew I needed to sustain the practice in order for the effects of mindfulness to have any power in my life. So I had enough discipline in me to know that if I wanted to apply mindfulness in daily life, I had to establish a daily sitting practice. And that had to be the foundation for taking it out in the world. And without the sitting in the morning, I would never be able to remember during the day. So sitting practice was a prerequisite for practicing. And, you know, each time I sat, I would, and I still do this sometime now, is I would reflect on what is my deepest aspirations. You know, why am I sitting? What do I want meditation to do to me? And after I sit, when I get up, right before, I ask the same question, like, what is my aspiration for today? What is something that I want to pay attention to? And so usually I pick a theme. And the theme, for example, might be something with movement. So I'll ask, I'll set the intention in my mind, may I notice when I'm rushing today? And may I remember to slow down? Or may I notice my body tensing up? And may I remember to stay soft. Sometimes I set a theme to remembering to do one thing at a time when I can. Sometimes it was a theme based on a book I was reading or something I was learning in the Buddhist studies class. Something like impermanence or maybe looking at one sense organ, seeing or hearing. But I had to have a theme and I had to work with something and I had to remind myself of that theme constantly. And so I pick one, I work with it for a day or for a week or sometimes even a month. And I found that it was a lot easier to remember that during the day if I wrote it down. So I would write it on sticky notes and post it in places where I knew I would look. And so I brought some examples. Now, these are not originals because the originals are really gnarly looking. But so for example, I would have one that just says soften. And I just post that sort of on my desk somewhere. In my drawer, I'd open it and it would say, just thoughts. And I have little clouds underneath the thoughts. What about now? What about right now? You know, I put this in my pocket. And whenever I go into my pocket, I would just feel the paper and then I would realize, oh, what about right now? And so these sort of external reminders were really important for me to remember to be present. Another one I have is, maybe not so. And I put this in my car. And so whenever I got in my car after I would teach, I always had ideas and opinions and views. And maybe not so. You know, don't believe what you're believing right now. And my favorite one, this too shall pass. I have this in my wallet. So those were some ways I remember the practice when I first started. And then I would also take some of Mark's early Dharma talks. This is a real old one from the newsletter. And I cut them up. And I would actually read these when I parked my car and before I would get out. I would actually read it and then just put it away. And then I get out of the car and start my day. Or I take it out maybe during lunch and just look at it again. If I didn't have these things, I simply would just forget. And then by the end of the day, it would dawn on me like, oh yeah, I totally forgot to practice today. So that was the way I established the practice in the beginning. And it's really amazing what I learned about intentions. The mind, I noticed that my mind would respond to my intentions and these reminders. And the intentions would start arising automatically. And the reminders would start becoming part of the software. And they would start popping up here and there in random situations. So this was how momentum was created for me. And at the end of the day, I would reflect on how I did. So, you know, what do I remember about how patient I was? Or did I remember to soften and slow down? And I just kind of reflect on how my day went. And then set an intention for the next day. And as my practice sort of deepened and I read more books and I kind of dabbled with more teachers and, you know, talked to Mark a lot, my faith and interest kind of grew. And the more I sat and the more I practiced in my daily life, the more sensitive I became to everything that was happening around me. And so the themes became much more driven by what was going on. And as a new teacher, my main theme and my teacher was fear. Generic fear. Fear was everywhere. When I was teaching, I was afraid to walk in the hallways. I was afraid of my students. I was afraid of the principal coming into my room. I was afraid of losing control of the classroom, of being exposed as a fraud, fear of not being respected. And I became really critical of everything in the system. And I come to Mark and I'd say, I can't take it. It's just too much. And he would just laugh and lean back and just be like, yep, your practice is deepening. And this is what happens when you become sensitive. And I noticed that I started externalizing the blame. And I'm sure a lot of you feel this way about your job sometimes. You know, you feel overwhelmed. You're fragmented. You feel powerless. You become frustrated, and over time you get demoralized. And then you start externalizing the blame, and everything becomes, it should be like this, and it shouldn't be like this. And teachers get into this mode a lot. And some of you know some teachers who fall into this trap. You know, the principals don't listen to us. The kids can't read. Poverty. The testing. The curriculum. And it's just on and on. So you can whip up a lot of aversion and discontent, you know, very quickly. And the system perpetuates itself where you're frustrated. You project the blame. You have a strong view about it. You're powerless because you can't change the situation, and then you fester in your anger, and then the system perpetuates itself. So does this sound familiar? So with these like really disturbing emotions, I needed something stronger than just these daily reminders. And so that's where my practice turned to the themes of compassion, loving kindness, forgiveness, and equanimity. Four essentials. A stable diet for any teacher to keep their sanity. So it's a template for harmonious relationships, and it's the antidote for any toxic mindset. So I would just sit and just bring to mind all my students who were such a pain to me and who wanted to ruin my life, which I was convinced, all my colleagues who were burnt out, the principal who has an impossible job, the parents who are stressed, and whether you're a teacher in a private school or an urban school or a suburb, it doesn't matter. We all have a burden. And I'd bring them in and hold them with compassion and forgive the conditions and, you know, try to bring a sense of equanimity and balance. And this also helped partially counterbalance the skewed distortions I had in my head about everything is broken, which is a very common view for teachers. So school is a great training ground for practice. These difficulties in my daily life with teaching became sort of the vehicles to awakening. And with the Brahma Viharas, you know, I learned how to open up and respond to the conditions with a little bit of greater ease and acceptance. Another way that I also practiced in daily life was not by theme, but by activity. And this is a more sort of intentional method where you take just one activity for a finite amount of time. It could be something as simple as just, you know, washing dishes or walking your dog or anything like that. And you just set an intention that you're going to bring as much awareness as you can to this one simple activity. And you try to rest in awareness just doing this one activity of folding the laundry, for example. And by setting that attention and committing to it, you'll see how the mind hijacks itself with all the thoughts coming in. But because you set that intention, you become aware of it, and you really see what's underneath the mind and what's kind of working underneath all our, you know, superficial thoughts. And so, you know, I use Joseph Goldstein's words, for the sake of this shower, for the sake of this jog, for the sake of this fill in the blank, there's nothing worth thinking about. You're not going to remember anything you're thinking about when you're doing this activity an hour from now, a week from now, a month from now. All these thoughts, you're not going to remember. And I'll tell myself that as I'm walking. And I'll even say, okay, well, let's see if I'm right. And by the end of the walk, I'll try to reflect on what was I thinking about in the beginning of this walk? And I have no idea. Which proves that, you know, the thoughts are not worth thinking about. So sometimes I would just be able to stay mindful for maybe half the time doing an activity. Sometimes I can only stay mindful for a quarter of the time. But what's important is that I'm planting the intention to be mindful, and I'm valuing the present moment, and I'm remembering the importance of the present moment. And the more times one can sort of habituate the momentary letting go of the thinking mind and rest in awareness, the more it punches holes in our trance of thought, and we can feel less stressed in those moments. And over time, mindfulness just arises on its own, and these become sort of, you know, these activities become habits. And then there's less dependence on somebody in the center of practice who has to do the practice. And it's more like effort is automatically there and the mind is doing the practice on its own. And so with these reminders, with setting the intentions, now it doesn't have to be so deliberate. Now it just kind of is sort of happening by itself. Wow, time flies, doesn't it? I wanted to say just a few things about being a parent. I have two kids, and they are great teachers. They're very challenging teachers. When mindfulness is strong, there's a lot of love and connection and a lot of joy. But they also can expose me to my deepest hang-ups, and it keeps me very humble, and it allows me to see my unexamined views. One of my unexamined views was that I realized was that I expected my kids to listen to me. I really did. Like, when I would tell them to do something, I expected them to do it immediately. And, like, when they didn't, I would just get impatient and grumpy and snappy. And it was like, in my mind, I realized there's this expectation that kids should listen to parents. And whenever there was resistance, I would just react to it. And so that's just one example where if I didn't have kids or if I wasn't committed to the practice, I probably would never have seen that unexamined view. And that expectation caused tons of tension and discord in my family. And, you know, they're the ones who make me aware of it. They say, "Daddy, you're being strict." Or, "Daddy, Mommy doesn't talk to us that way. Go meditate." You know? And so there's a feedback loop where they really keep you on your toes. And so I try to model for them how, an adult deals with their sort of emotional neurosis. And they see me practicing. You know, like, my son Liam is very loud. He's 8 years old. He loves screeching. He's theatrical and silly. And he'll just, you know, you put some beats in front of him at the dinner table and he'll scream. And my ears are really sensitive to noise. And I'm just like, and I can get really impatient and snap at him. And sometimes I catch myself and there's a moment of awareness where I'm aware of the emotions. I feel that burning irritation arising, that surge. I kind of disengage a little bit, and I let it be there, and I don't say anything. And my daughter will look at me and say, "Daddy, what are you doing?" And I'll say, "I'm being mindful of the irritation that Liam's causing." And she goes, "Daddy, you're so Buddha-ish." You know, and so they keep it light, and they make fun of me, which, you know, I'm fine with, because, you know, I want to be authentic in how I practice, and I want to show them, like, you know, I'm trying, and they see that I'm trying, and I try not to preach or, you know, impose it on them. I just want to live with integrity, and they'll learn from me what they can. I try to get them to reflect on their desire, like, how many Legos do you really need, Liam, and how many stuffed animals is really going to make you happier, Ava? You know, I try to get them to think about their aversion. You know, we have this chant, "All pain goes away." So whenever they hurt themselves, I chant that so they can just reflect on the pain's going to go away. And then I try to get them to think about how they treat things like bugs. You know, I have a soft spot for bugs. And when there's a mosquito in the house, they love killing mosquitoes. So they go after it. And then I'm after it to save the mosquito. And it becomes a very comical scene where I'm trying to save the mosquito and they're trying to kill it. And my wife thinks I'm totally ridiculous. And I admit I am a little bit. But the point is that, you know, I don't really, I mean, they're going to kill the mosquito, and I get that. But they know that I don't condone it. And I, you know, I value life, and I'm practicing non-harming in my life. And so they kind of respect that, although they don't buy it yet. So anyway, I try to be a model for my kids and just practice with some authenticity so that I can kind of pass it on through them in some way or form. I think I went over time. Okay, so I'll just close by saying that, retreats are great, and I certainly encourage you to go on retreat. But the real bread and butter is, I think, the daily life and your ordinary situations. And the most important thing is arousing the intention to practice and making it the center of your life and seeing the benefits of it. And unless the practice is, you know, for me, it has to be top dog. It has to be the highest priority. And then everything else falls in line. And for those of you who've been practicing a lot and you feel like you're kind of stuck or you're not really seeing, some gains, it's probably because there's not enough momentum or continuity in your daily life. And the more times you can kind of have momentary, small moments, many times of mindfulness and awareness, that builds the momentum. And then when you go on retreat, you know, you're not starting from zero, you're starting from maybe, you know, four or five. Whereas if you don't practice in your daily life and you go on retreat, you might get to nine, but then once retreat's over, you might be back to, you know, zero. So the idea is to keep the momentum going throughout your day so that wisdom can kind of accumulate in small places. And now I'll turn it over to Wynn, who's going to talk a little bit about wise speech, I believe.
Okay. Can you hear me? Is that all right? Okay. All right. For those of you that don't know me, my name's Wynn Fricke. I'm actually one of the co-founders of Common Ground with Mark Nunberg, who is my longtime partner and pal. Common Ground started seven blocks away from here, and it has just had a chance to grow slowly over the years, and the practice has been immensely important to me from the beginning, and it has changed my life in crucial ways. So I'm always happy to sort of reflect on it and talk about it and share it. So, thinking about daily life and practice in daily life, and like Paul, you know, I work full time. I don't have a family, but I have a busy profession, and it's a constant question of how to keep my practice alive, because I care. I really care about it. And one thing that has become a kind of anchor is speech, how I communicate. So wise speech is one of the things that the Buddha also pointed to as something that it would be of value to us to pay attention to, because we all know the kind of power our words have to harm or to heal. So I thought tonight I would talk about speech, because we talk all day long. We talk, and we can be casual about our words, or we can have a lot of care behind them, and be aware of their potential to cause harm. You know, so. Yeah, and to recognize too that that our speech is preceded by our thoughts, right? Our thoughts give rise to the words that come out of our mouth. So if we are not able to be sensitive or attentive to how we communicate, how are we ever going to be attentive to the workings of the mind and thoughts that fuel our speech? So it's a really practical way of actually getting closer to our mind, is to look at our speech. Here are some of the Buddha's words. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. If one speaks or acts with careless thought, pain follows them. If one speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness follows them, like a shadow that never leaves them. The wise one fashions speech. The wise ones fashion speech with their thought, sifting it as grain is sifted through a sieve. So, probably many of you know that right speech is one of the precepts. So, every quarterly gathering, we chant the five precepts. So, these are trainings in mindfulness. And so the Buddha had a very special category alone for speech, pay attention to speech. And the other place speech is located in the Eightfold Path. So I'll just talk a little bit about both of these. So our right speech, our fourth mindfulness training, I'll just read it. So the basic training, I undertake the training rule to refrain from false speech. So it's really basic, right? We speak the truth. We do our best not to spin, not to exaggerate. We speak clearly. We speak honestly. And Thich Nhat Hanh, maybe many of you know, he's a Vietnamese monk from the Mahayana tradition. He elaborates a little bit on this precept, and I'll just read what he says because I think it's pithy and it's beautiful. And he says, aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and inability to listen to others, I am committed to cultivating loving speech and compassionate listening in order to relieve suffering and to promote reconciliation and peace in myself and among other people, ethnic and religious groups, and nations. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I am committed to speaking truthfully, using words that inspire confidence, joy, and hope. When anger is manifesting in me, I am determined not to speak. So that's a tall order, right? When anger is manifesting in me, I am determined not to speak. I will practice mindful breathing and walking in order to recognize and to look deeply into my anger. I know that the roots of anger can be found in my wrong perceptions and lack of understanding of the suffering in myself and in the other person. I will speak and listen in a way that can help myself and the other person to transform suffering and see the way out of a difficult situation. I am determined not to spread news that I do not know to be certain, and not to utter words that can cause division or discord. I will practice right diligence to nourish my capacity for understanding, love, joy, and inclusiveness, and gradually transform anger, violence, and fear that lie deep in my consciousness. So right speech is considered one of the factors on the Eightfold Noble Path. So the Eightfold Noble Path is the path the Buddha articulated that leads to the awakening of our hearts and minds. And the Eightfold Noble Path is functional, it's useful in the beginning, it's useful in the middle, and useful in the end. So it's a path that serves all the way along. And right speech falls in a category of good conduct. So part of that Eightfold Noble Path, he has a category which is sort of broadly good conduct. So it's how we act, how we speak, how we make our living. Those are things we need to attend to. And it's like considered, if you can picture a stool, like a stool has three legs. So the Eightfold Noble Path is supported by three legs. So one is the good conduct. One is mental development. So that's what we do here on the cushion. We're developing concentration. We're developing mental clarity. We're developing good effort and mindfulness. And then the third leg of the stool is right attitude or right aspiration and right view. That's the wisdom leg. So conduct, wisdom, mental training. These are the three supports in the Eightfold Path that lead to awakening. So the shaping of our character is not peripheral, but central to the development of our minds. And the shaping of our character we can do all day long. You know, we can do it lovingly. We can do it in our interpersonal relationships. We can do it at work. And we do it by paying attention. It's not about being good, you know, I have to be good. It's about seeing what works, what opens the heart, what opens the mind. Here's some more of Buddha's words. So he's speaking to his son, Rahula. Rahula, do you see the little bit of water that is left in this bowl? Just a little bit of water in the bowl. Such is the spiritual achievement of one who is not afraid to speak a deliberate lie. Then the Buddha throws the water away, and he puts the bowl upside down. Do you see, Rahula, how this water has been discarded? In the same way, one who tells a deliberate lie disregards whatever spiritual achievements they have made. Do you see how this bowl is now empty? One who has no shame in telling lies is empty of spiritual achievement. So telling the truth. We have, let's go into these in depth. So we have a little time yet. Five characteristics of right speech. So the first one is speaking the truth, okay? And that might seem like a no-brainer, but I feel like it's important to reflect on how often we might spin the truth or exaggerate the truth as a form of protection for ourselves or maybe protection for somebody else, how we shape the truth to meet our need. And he has so much to say. I realize if I say everything, I won't get through the list. So I'll just start with some examples, and we can reflect together with examples in our lives of like places where maybe we created some confusion by not speaking the truth. So I was just kind of faced with this. A little bit ago, I was sort of the head of a search committee at McAllister College. I run the dance program there, and we did a search for a position on the faculty. And being kind of a dancer and being connected to a lot of dancers, a lot of the people in that search were my friends. And I had to be in ongoing relationship with them about kind of this job that they were applying for. And then I had to be the one that sent them all emails or called them when they didn't get the job. We had a lot of applicants. And I noticed, and in one case in particular where I felt it was going to be particularly poignant, the not getting the job, the email, I shaped it in a way that made the reason seem, in a way what I perceived would be less hurtful than the real reasons why that person didn't get the job. I just spinned it a little bit because I was concerned about their well-being. I was concerned that they would lose confidence. I was concerned about myself. I just had a lot of concern. And so I was aware, you know, I didn't lie, but I really wasn't transparent. I wasn't pointed about, you know, this was why this job didn't happen. And that came around to bite me in the butt. It led to confusion in that person, and it came around. And so it's like just taking care with my words. And in a case like this, probably if I had said less, that would have been better. Less is more, you know. So just learning. But that kind of diligence. And I was diligent as I wrote it, but still, I thought, this would be acceptable, but it was learning for me. And then how a lie can just tumble out of our mouths when we're in a moment and we've caught off guard, you know, that we can backtrack in those moments. I had a moment like that with my husband. We were just walking, and you know, our relationship is really transparent, but he asked me a question that it caught me off guard, and before I could stop, I just shout out this little lie. And it was not consequential in any way, but there was part of me that just didn't, I was just afraid like that, like telling the truth would be too complicated or just something like that. And I heard it, and he accepted it, and we were walking, and it was like, I just felt in, you know, because I've made a commitment. So this is important, right? Because you were talking about commitment. We make a commitment, so it shines a light on those moments where we are not kind of following through, and like, why did I tell that lie? And, you know, and so it was so hard, but after about a minute of like, you know, my first thought was, oh, just do better next time, Wynn, you know, just like, let it go. But it was like, this is my most intimate relationship. We have like this spiritual contract, you know, we are in this relationship, and it's like, I just don't want to be sloppy, you know. And so after about another minute, I kind of said, Mark, that wasn't true what I said, you know, and it was terrible. I mean, I was just so, it was so hard to say it, and then I'm so glad I said it, you know, because it was just, it's just, not that it was that meaningful in any way, but just, that's just how I want to be. I just want to be clear in that way. I don't want to, yeah. This is Bhikkhu Bodhi. Truthful speech establishes a correspondence between our own inner being and the real nature of phenomena, allowing wisdom to rise up and fathom their real nature. Thus, much more than an ethical principle, devotion to truthful speech is a matter of taking our stand on reality rather than illusion, on the truth grasped by wisdom rather than the fantasies woven by desire. And I have, you know, we could pick any number of examples in our political system about how lying can become a strategy, you know. So recognizing culturally, there are a lot of views out there that we need to be aware of. Okay, so lying, that's the first. The second, we speak at the right time. So, I can imagine too, like, you know, in all of our most intimate relationships, when we're really heated, when someone is kind of hurling rocks at you with their words, and it has a violent feel, and you feel hurt by that, what do we want to do back? Really, what do we usually want to do back? We want to defend, and we want to hurl back. And to recognize that impulse seated in ill will isn't useful. So when I recognize that, I want to hurl some rocks back, I just recognize, keep in mind when what you have to say, but just say it later. It's not like suppressing, it's not like avoiding, but just give yourself a moment, take a walk, you know, come back, say it at a different time. So just being sensitive, being wise, when is the right time to say something? And when can someone hear something? We can really be sensitive to that too, recognize they can't hear this right now. Now is not the time, you know, and find a time when they're in a better space to hear it. Maybe I'll just tell a brief story because it relates a little to what Paul was saying. I was a high school teacher for a little while, teaching dance in a high school, and there was one, you know, teenagers sometimes were difficult. I was new to teaching. There was one teenager in my dance class who just was really hard for me. It was kind of, her behavior set me off, and I didn't know how to contain it, and I didn't know how to talk to her, and it was a real effort to kind of like speaking at the right time and using words that were honest and all that stuff. And so this was like a year-long adventure of how to communicate with her and be true to myself. And then one day I was particularly provoked, and I responded out of reactivity, and I let fly from my mouth a tumble of words that would have gotten me fired had anybody heard that in the administration. And this is true. It was just like, and I shocked myself. It just was sort of this tumble of words. And interestingly, the relationship changed after that incident. So I'm not sure what the point of it is, but it made me reflect on, the kind of, like, my speaking to her in all that year was not rooted in compassion at all. I wanted to fix the problem. I wanted to put her in her place. That's what it was rooted in. So now, no matter how kind, how measured, how rational my words were, it wasn't rooted in compassion. And not that she would have heard it necessarily anyway. That's my job, though. That's my job, to know where my words are coming from. So this is a place where we need to attend, especially when there's heat, especially when there's a charge. Okay, C, it is spoken affectionately. So we speak our words affectionately. Irina Weissman, when she was here, I was talking to her, and she said something so powerful, because I was sort of asking her about, you know, when, you know, at school situations, you know, around diversity and stuff, I see sometimes that students attack each other. You know, this sort of attacking thing. And as a leader, I didn't know kind of like how to work with it. But anything, one thing that she said, a little nugget of wisdom about words, and she says for herself, If it's not friendly, it's not true. If her words are not friendly, they're not true. I thought, wow, that's like a high order. That's like saying, for the words to be friendly, they need to be rooted really in the Brahma Viharas, right? In loving kindness, in compassion, in gladness, in equanimity. If they're not rooted in that, what are they rooted in? Our characteristics of ill will, of ignorance, of greed. So just as a tall order, if it's not friendly, it's not true. And then finally, words should be spoken beneficially versus like idle speech or gossip. Gandhi said, speak only if it improves upon the silence. I love that. I've kind of, those weren't the Buddha's words, but I kind of have taken them to heart. And just looking at gossiping, which can cause divisiveness and pain, as we know, and can sometimes feel harmless, but is it? And then why do we do it? You know, or why do we feel compelled to do it? Or like we're in a social circle and we kind of have to do, you know, whatever that is. So a place to look at closely. So do we use our words to heal? Do we use our words to enlighten? And I just want to tell a story here too, because this was powerful for me. This was years ago when we were in the old space where one of the people that came to a program, I ran into him in a different context. It was in a park somewhere. It was just an acquaintance. And he was talking to me about the Dhamma talk and about a little story that Mark told that was really funny and a little bit exposing. And I knew the story. And, you know, I had known the story before, but he was just kind of sharing it and laughing about it because it kind of struck him in a particular way. And I kind of was laughing with him. It was a great story. And then a few days later, he called me, and he said, you know, I didn't quite feel right about how I talked about that story or if I should have talked about that story. You know, he just felt sensitive, like somehow where he was coming from as he talked about it, or his question, like, well, what's said in the Dharma Hall, does it stay in the Dharma Hall? You know, he just had these doubts that kind of came up. And the nature of the story was pretty personal. So, it was kind of interesting because I hadn't thought a thing about it. I laughed with him. I thought it was great. But what I remembered was how much I respected that gesture, that he would call, that he would have that level of concern, just to make sure no residue was left or that he hadn't misstepped, or just to, if he had, he wanted to acknowledge it. So I remember that example, and that was one of the examples that gave me the courage to kind of backtrack when I lied to Mark, you know, like, oh, just come clean, when, you know, it's okay, just come clean. And just as an added thing, the Buddha had a word for useless speech. It was one of those onomatopoeias that the word sounds like what it is referring to. Sampapapalapa. Sampapapalapa is useless speech. Okay, and then the last one, and then we'll open it up. That our words are spoken with a mind of goodwill. And I want to take this opportunity, this fifth one in the Buddha's examples, to quote something that he said that I think is challenging to all of us, but I think it's worth saying. He says, practitioners, and this is about how we speak, but also about how we listen. He says, practitioners, others may address you in a timely way or an untimely way. They may address you with what is true or what is false. They may address you in an affectionate way or a harsh way. They may address you in a beneficial way or an unbeneficial way. They may address you with a mind of goodwill or with inner hate. In any event, you should train yourselves. Our minds will be unaffected and we will say no evil words. We will remain sympathetic to that person's welfare with a mind of goodwill and with no inner hate. So when someone addresses us with inner hate, can we be steadfast? Do we have to return that inner hate, you know, which is sort of which is sort of our reflexive response, right? Can we be anchored in something else, you know? And that's our practice, right? That's our practice. And just to add one thought to that, how do we speak to ourselves? And especially, how do we speak to ourselves when we've been full of ill will? When we've been creating havoc with our conduct, how do we speak to ourselves? So the same holds true. We speak to ourselves anchored in kindness, anchored in compassion, not anchored in ill will. And so I think this is like beautiful, like, because we think somehow it's okay to do violence to ourselves with our words. You know, we think somehow that that will get us into shape, or, but I think it actually has the opposite effect. Pema Chodron, trying to fix ourselves is not helpful. It implies struggle and self-denigration. Denigrating ourselves is probably the most common and major way we cover our bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is our pure heart, pure mind. So that kind of violent speech that we direct inward is another place to look at closely. You know, sometimes we can't help it. It's just kind of raging in our minds. But how can we begin to investigate closely?
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.